Our next speaker this morning is Mike Harnett, Director of Operations, Work Smart Ergonomics, a consulting firm that specializes in physical, cognitive, and organizational ergonomics, including shift work and fatigue management programming. Mike has more than 20 years of experience as both a practitioner and manager of ergonomic systems. Raised in Alberta, she has consulted on many projects in the Canadian oil sands. In her presentation, Shattering Myths, the New Face of Fatigue Management, she will discuss the most recent scientific research on the best way to maximize safety and performance while minimizing the effects of fatigue as they relate to shift work. How about a warm welcome from Mike?
Good morning, everybody. You're not reading incorrectly. This is the most difficult part of the presentation right here, having you digest my name, okay? Once you get past the mic part, it's all good, all right? It is a bit of a conversation piece, so if you want to talk about it later, you can come buy me a beer, I'll explain it. Now, so I'm here to talk about fatigue management. I just want to give you a very, very brief introduction as to why I'm even up here speaking about it. My very first job back in 1986 was with CN Railway up in Canada. And within 6 months, we had a very horrific and tragic incident that occurred. In fact, it was the biggest industrial accident in Canada at the time. And basically what had happened is we took a 100-plus car freight train and drove it through a passenger train. And we killed 23 people. And that event, when they did the inquiry, we came back with this great big huge report, and it discovered over 300 contributing factors as to why that incident occurred. And at the top of the list, first, poor safety culture, and the next five all had to do with shift work and fatigue management, or rather, the lack of understanding of those. So I was kind of thrust into that stream of ergonomics, and that's why I'm here today. So, make sure I've got everything in order here. Okay. Is this the wrong one? Oh, sorry, wrong one. There we go. All right, so I did a little research before I came here, and I went to NIOSH and the Center of Disease Control, and these are the facts that I found out, that the workforce here, in terms of the U.S. mining sector, tends to be significantly older compared to other industries. Workers in extractive industries tend to work longer hours, an average of 10 hours more. These are non-supervisory workers, all right? Many mines are in remote locations, or what we often call drive-in, drive-out operations, or DIDO or FIFO operations, fly-in, fly-out operations. And as a result, there's a lot of long commute times that add to the equation of fatigue and cumulative fatigue. Excuse me. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to actually tie in the rest of this presentation with these three factors that we've talked about. So, here are the contributing factors to fatigue. There's a little bit of theory that we have to go through in order to present the actual findings first. So there are three things that we look at that really contribute to the development of fatigue in an individual. First is circadian rhythms, which we'll talk about very briefly, shift design, and finally, the quality and quantity of sleep that an individual gets. So in terms of circadian rhythms, we basically have all of these rhythms in our body that are tied to the synchronization of the rotation of our planet, 24 hours. Now, we have over 700 body rhythms, and they tell us things like when we should eat, when we should sleep, and things we're not even aware of, things like certain hormones should be released now, our blood pressure should go up, our digestion should slow down. But the mother of all rhythms is what we call the body temperature curve. And what this does is it kind of harmonizes all of the other rhythms in our body. Now, if we have shift workers or people that are working on night shift, we've got some challenges with this body temperature curve, because basically what happens is, as the sun goes up, our body starts to wake up. We start to feel more energetic, we start to feel physically stronger, and cognitively we begin to be at our best. So as the sun goes up, we hit a peak around 11, 12 in the morning, and we feel pretty darn good about ourselves. And then we have lunch, and we hit that siesta period, where we all just want to have a nice little nap, don't we? Now that's a built-in dip in our circadian rhythm. It's actually a time that, in some countries, they'll actually embrace that and slow work down. But unfortunately, in a lot of our operations, it's go, 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 24/7. We don't have time to slow down. We got to keep going. So we pile through. And that break between 1 and 4 is a really tough time for a lot of people to focus mentally. And in fact, emergency services hate that time of day because that's when they see the most traffic accidents. Then we peak out later in the day, usually around, well, it depends on where you are in the country and the height of the sun, maybe 7, 8 at night for most people. And then as the sun sets, our body temperature drops.
And as our body temperature drops, our digestion slows, and our breathing slows, and our heart rate slows, and everything is telling the body to prepare itself for sleep. And it's during sleep that the body fully repairs itself. When we start affecting our sleep, we start affecting our ability to function. And that's going to affect your performance. All right, so we're going to bottom out somewhere between 4 and 6 in the morning is going to be the worst time for a person to operate and be functioning at a good level. That's where we're going to see the most incidents. So what does all this mean? There we go. All right. So what we want to do is consider that we can't just take this body temperature curve and flip it upside down. All right? We're not designed to be that way. We are a day-oriented species. We are designed to be awake during daytime hours and asleep at night. We can't turn you into a rat or a bat, which are nocturnal. All right? So what this means is if we want to create a change in a person, we can slowly adjust that cycle, but we will never fully change you into a nighttime animal. It just doesn't work that way. But the best we can do is allow you for a transition to get to as close as a night person as possible. But here are the rules for that. For every hour of shift change, so if you're going from a 12-hour day to a 12-hour night, it's going to require one day for every hour of shift change for that person to adapt to that new schedule. So that means when they go onto that night shift at 7 o'clock at night, the first night their body hasn't adapted, the second night it hasn't, the third it hasn't, the fourth. It's not going to be until the 12th night that their body has actually adapted as much as it will ever adapt, and it will never fully adapt. So that leaves us with a situation. Well, what do we do? Do we keep people on for 12 nights in a row? Now they're adapted. Well, we might as well take advantage of that and keep them working. Well, that's not going to work very well for most people. So the question then becomes, do we want to adjust? Do we want the body to go through this transition? Here's the problem with that transition. Day one or night one that you're on shift work, you're not feeling too good, but you power through it, and your body says, okay, I'll let you get away with it. Night two, body goes, okay, this isn't fun anymore. I'm not enjoying this. Night three, okay, I see what you're doing. I'm going to start adjusting a little bit. Night four, that's when it really starts to tie in to the adjustment phase. So we start building up this jet lag. All right? Now, here's the problem is when we do that, you can have a person work several nights in a row and they're going through jet lag, jet lag, jet lag, jet lag, jet lag, and they finally get to that adjustment phase. But as soon as you give them a day off, they automatically revert to their daytime schedule, don't they? Because on days off, you want to hang with the real people, not the mole people anymore. So as soon as you take days off and you resort back to a day schedule, you lose all of that entrainment. So when you go back to that night shift the next time, you're back at square one. We don't have the ability to train ourselves and stay as a night shift person unless we live a night shift lifestyle all the time. Okay, I think the batteries are maybe going on this a little bit. All right, so in terms of shift work design, we do have a lot of people that come up to us and say, well, just tell me what the perfect shift schedule is, and that's what we'll use. Well, there is no such thing as a perfect shift schedule because it depends on the type of work, depends on the hours of work, depends on whether it's physically demanding, cognitively demanding, when they occur in the schedule. It also depends on factors like younger workers versus older workers. Younger workers, their biggest beef in life is, how do I fit in my family and friends? Older shift workers, they've given up on a social life. They don't care anymore. They're divorced. They just want to get through the day without acid indigestion and heartburn and sleep disorders. So we have to recognize there are different impacts on those schedules and how we design them. All right, in terms of shift rotations, we do know that shorter shift rotations are better than longer shift rotations, strictly from a physiological standpoint. In other words, we don't want people to work more than 2 to 3, 2 to 4 nights maximum in a row. And what that's going to do is minimize that adjustment or shifting into jet lag phase. Okay? Once we go beyond 4 nights, we're really going to see an impact, and I'll show you some slides on that in a minute. Now, there are some operations that keep people strictly on night shift all the time. If they're not rotating, sometimes it's a little bit easier. But in those situations, it's only going to work if they adopt a full nighttime lifestyle. That means on their days off, they still sleep during the day, and they do all their family and social and recreational activities at nighttime. It's not too many people you're going to find that like to live that kind of a lifestyle. Now, shutdown operations are a very dangerous situation where we'll have a shutdown crew come in and they'll work 30 days or nights in a row. And now we've had some companies that thought, well, you know what, obviously that's a bad thing. So what we'll do is we'll let them work maybe 15 nights in a row, and then we'll force them to take a couple of days off, and then we'll bring them back again. Well, that's actually one of the worst things you can do at that point, because if you give them those 2 days off, you've just lost all that entrainment, and now you're going to bring them back on another 15-night schedule. So we have to start revisiting, how are we setting up our schedules for fatigue? So one of the biggest things that's going to impact our fatigue levels is exposure to light. All right, light is the big synchronizing agent for all of our body rhythms. Now, when it comes to light, light can depress the production of what we call melatonin. Melatonin is our natural, sleep hormone in our body. We call it the Dracula of hormones because it's only produced in the absence of light. So if we have people that are working at nighttime and they are exposed to a lot of light, and the brighter the light, the worse it is, it suppresses the production of melatonin. And that's why so many shift workers don't sleep well. It's because they don't have enough melatonin being produced that when they get off of night shift, they go home, they can't fall asleep, or they don't get a good quality of sleep. All right? Now, as we get older, melatonin production is already being diminished in us. Now, in some countries, age is a big factor when it comes to shift work. In fact, in Europe, in a lot of countries in Europe, you're not allowed to be a shift worker if you're over the age of 45. It's also a very powerful antioxidant, and what that means is there has been significant links in research between people who work shift work and the development of certain things like cancer and diabetes. In fact, 50% higher diabetes risk for those who work shift work. And certainly increase for certain types of cancers. And that's because melatonin is also this very powerful antioxidant, which means it wraps up or mops up all the free radicals that are in our body that affect the DNA structure. So in terms of some general recommendations when it comes to light exposure in an organization, and primarily I'm talking more about control room environments at this point, fluorescent lights, which are predominantly white light, that's the hardest on our body in terms of circadian rhythms, also in terms of some health complications such as migraines. We'd like to see fluorescent lights replaced with full-spectrum bulbs wherever possible. We also want to make sure that people understand that we want to keep light as low as possible during nighttime operations. Certainly, you want enough light that you can see your activities and do what you need to do. Red light is actually the best in those environments. It has the least impact on circadian rhythms. Blue light is probably one of the most damaging forms of light, so there are glasses that will block out blue light. But in the absence of having specific red, white, or blue light, you can get full-spectrum bulbs, which would probably be your best bet. You want exposure to these lights between 5 and 6 a.m. in the morning, and after 8 p.m. you want to start toning them down. All right. So less light exposure at nighttime, bright light exposure after about 5 to 6 a.m. in the morning, because we do need that boost of light early in the morning, because that resets our circadian rhythms and keeps us synchronized on the rotation of the planet. A little hard to explain in a very short time frame. I apologize for that. The slides do have a lot of content on them, but that's to help you when you leave here, so I won't be going necessarily through all of the content on the slides. This is research that was done by Liberty Mutual, the research institute led by Simon Focard, Philip Tucker, and Lombardi. And what they've done is they are very good at measuring the effects of shift schedules on incidence and relative risk. And this particular slide shows morning shifts versus afternoon shifts versus night shifts. And what they discovered is an afternoon shift has an 18% increase in relative risk for incidence to occur, and a 30% increase in risk during night shift operations. Now, the next thing they looked at was the number of nights that are worked in a row. After the first night, if you work 2 nights in a row, your relative risk increased to 6%. The third night, 17%. The fourth night, 36%. Then they looked at the length of shift, and they looked at 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. So the big ones, of course, are the 8, 10, and 12-hour shifts, and those are the ones that I've got highlighted on here. If you compare the 10-hour shift to the 8-hour shift, you're going to see a 13% increase in relative risk, and a 12-hour shift, a 27% increase in relative risk. Now let's put this all together. Let's say you've got guys that work 12-hour shifts, and they work more than 4 nights in a row, and they work night shift. Wow, what does that do to your relative risk? increases, doesn't it? So we need to start looking at our shift schedules. Some of the things that have been researched out, this was a study completed by Circadian Technologies. They did a compendium of all this research out there. And this is the general recommendations that came out of it. We recommend 11 to 16 hours off between shifts. If you give less than 10 hours, that results in short sleep periods. But when the time off occurs is just as important as the length, because giving them 12 hours off or 10 hours or 8 hours off at 2 in the afternoon is a lot different from giving it off at 10 o'clock at night. We know that we sleep better, we have better quality sleep, and we can sleep longer if it's during dark nighttime hours. We want 24 hours off after a block of night shifts. We recommend a maximum of 48 hours of work per week, and especially if they're working 12-hour shifts, we don't like to see a lot of overtime or on-call situations. Now, that may require some adjustment on some of the work schedules that are out there, but that's the best that we can recommend from a physiological standpoint, what's going on with the body. Now, in terms of sleep factors, some things to notice. Overall in society, stand closer. In the last 100 years, we've actually dropped our rate of sleep from averaging over 9 hours of sleep to now averaging less than 7 hours of sleep. It used to be that when the sun got up, we got up, and when the sun went down, we went down. There wasn't much left to do in the nighttime at those back 100 years ago other than procreate. We were pretty good at that back then. But now, we have this manufactured light, thank you to Thomas Edison, who just screwed up all of our lives, and now we've extended our work day, and we creep into our nighttime sleep, and there's going to be consequences to that, and we're beginning to see that more and more. Now, most of our quality sleep comes early on when we go to bed. I'll explain more about that in a moment. And only sleep can cure fatigue. You cannot Starbuck it away. You cannot Red Bull it away. It's like thirst. If you're thirsty, you need to drink water or some kind of compatible liquid. If you're hungry, you need food. If you're tired, you need sleep. Everything else is just a mask. So how much is enough? Well, most of us are going to require between 7.5 and 8 hours as a minimum. All right? As a minimum. There's another third of our population that require more than 9 hours of sleep to function at their best and not have any consequences of it. All right? Quick question. How many of you average 8 hours of sleep a day? Not a lot of hands up. Closer to 7? Closer to 6? Oh. Less than 6? I hope you're not driving. Okay, that's not a good sign. All right. If you miss out on 1 hour of sleep less than what your body has been programmed for, we can see the effects the next day. We can measurably determine that fatigue in your body. And you know what's a really good test case for that? The number of traffic incidents that we see after daylight savings time every year. As soon as we switch that clock back by an hour, or rather move it ahead for an hour, it's amazing the number of road incidents that we see just because of a one-hour shift change. Now, our age will drop our ability to get good quality sleep, and in fact, as we get older, we start averaging closer to 5 to 6 hours of sleep. And this is the normal population, not shift workers. Shift workers are averaging closer to 4 to 5 hours when they're trying to sleep during daytime operations, or during daytime, not during operations. And you cannot train yourself to get by with less sleep than your body has been programmed for. Now, a lot of people always come up to me and say, well, my body obviously knows what it needs because I don't even need an alarm clock. It just wakes up on its own. That's simply routine. Your body has adjusted to it. That doesn't mean you're getting the sleep that you require. Okay? So this is a courtesy of NASA, and it's just a kind of a depiction of our sleep schedule and what our brain waves look like and what they're doing. So the reason I've got this up here is I just wanted to point out, if you look at the bottom, these are the number of hours after you go to bed. So you've got 1 through 8. So if we look at 1 through 4, on the bottom left-hand side, you're going to see stage 3 and 4. That's what we call delta sleep. That is our quality sleep. That is really important for us to get to because it's during that phase of sleep that our body physically repairs itself. It's the only time the human growth hormone is released. So it physically repairs all of our tissues, our organs, and most importantly, our immune system. People that don't get good quality sleep because they've got people that come and wake them up, dogs barking, kids playing outside and they're trying to sleep during daytime, or any kind of disruption, if they don't have a good dark room, All of these things can interfere with the quality of sleep. And these are the people that seem to potentially walk around with a runny nose or a cold or a virus of some sort, and they just feel physically tired and exhausted all the time. All right? But the longer we sleep, the more we transition and spend more time in REM sleep, which is our dreamscape, rapid eye movement. It's during this phase of sleep that our body mentally and cognitively refreshes itself. So the longer we sleep, the more we spend in REM. But traditionally, we continually cut back on our sleep, and shift workers in particular don't get enough quantity of sleep. That means we're cutting out a lot of REM. Now, REM is really important because not only does it repair things like keeps us sharp for reaction times, performance decisions, motor response, it's also critically important for consolidation of our memory, both short-term and long-term. So when we constantly cut back on our sleep, we're really affecting our cognitive processing. And these are the people that you've got with their hands on controls. All right, so what happens when we start cutting back on our sleep? Well, we start to accumulate what's called sleep debt. Now, what sleep debt does after a while is our brain will say, you know what, you're not looking after me, so I'm going to start taking charge. So the first step of when you've acquired too much sleep debt is when we start to experience things like autopilot or automatic behavior syndrome. Have you ever pulled into your driveway and you sit there for a second and you go, huh, how did I get here? You don't remember the drive home? When you ask that question to shift workers, they'll say, oh, yeah, almost every day. And it's because driving home is a very regular routine event. The body and the brain recognize this, and they go, you know what? Nothing ever happens on the drive home. This is a good time for me to just power down a little bit and go into autopilot. And thank God that no animal has jumped across the road, or maybe a new light switch, thankfully, hasn't gone up, because you may not have noticed it. You made it home. You think you're good. If you let that sleep that accumulate, then the brain really takes over, and we call this a microsleep. And this is a stage where the brain says, you know what, screw you, you haven't been looking after me, I'm out of here. And it's going to choose a very routine event, like driving home at the end of a shift, and it's going to say, you know what, nothing ever happens, this is a good time for me to just go, I'm out of here. You don't see anything, you don't hear anything, you receive no sensory input. And this individual is operating a vehicle, a 2,000, 3,000 pound vehicle down a highway. And what's going to happen? They're not going to know that they're falling asleep. And they can have their eyes wide open, hands on the wheel. And as we get tired, our foot actually gets heavier on the pedal when we fall asleep in a microsleep state. So this results in high speed incidents. And typically what happens is the individual who's driving in a fatigue state ends up perishing. And this is a lot different from a drunk driver in a lot of cases. A drunk driver, when they have an incident, they often are the ones that survive. Now, when I ask people, why do you think drunk drivers survive? And the first response I always get back is, oh, it's because they're relaxed. Well, who do you think is more relaxed, the person who's actually physically asleep or the person who's just kind of asleep and drunk? The reality is being relaxed is only about muscle relaxation. It is not going to stop the tearing away of your organs internally from a collision, which is why most people die. It's internal bleeding. All right, so that's a fallacy. The reason a drunk driver survives is because they still have sensory input. It's garbled, but they have some sensory input. And a lot of times what happens is they realize at the last minute something is going horribly wrong. So what do? They turn that wheel as a self-preservation method, putting their passenger or other people in the vehicle in the line of fire first. And that's often why they survive. And it's not because, oh, I don't like Bob, I'm going to put him in the line of fire. It's just an unconscious effort. It's self-preservation built into us. So, in terms of short-term wakefulness, some great research that came out of Australia, Lamond and Dawson, and what they've been able to correlate is how impaired we are when we look at blood alcohol impairment versus fatigue impairment. And here's what they've come up with, and it's been validated several times since. If you've been awake for 17 hours, just awake, not drinking, you are now at the blood alcohol equivalent of 0.05%. Now, in Canada, that's the legal limit in many provinces, 0.05%. If you've been awake for 22 hours, you are now at 0.08%. And if you've been awake for 24 hours, there we go, 0.10. Now, here's an interesting fact about shift workers. Over 50% of shift workers do not sleep before reporting to that first night shift. They'll stay up the entire day and then go on to the night shift. So they'll be up for way more than 24 hours. Now, anyone who's up for more than 24 hours, this was research done with Pat Burns, who is a biotechnologist, and he suggests that if you've been awake for 24 hours, it's going to require 5 days of periods of 9 hours of sleep for you to offset that 24 hours of being awake. Wow. All right. So in terms of fatigue-related technology, really important for me to stress this. Technology is a tool. It is not a solution. Big distinction there. And to build on what's already been said, certainly by Bruce and by Larry, we have to have this balance between technology and education and training, both from the worker perspective, the supervisory perspective, and certainly up to the management perspective. So very quickly, there are two things that we can measure when it comes to this area. We can measure sleep, and we can measure fatigue, two different things. So to measure sleep, typically sleep is measured in a sleep lab or a medical clinic, and you're hooked up to all kinds of cables, and they'll measure things like your heart rate, muscle movement, brain waves, that type of thing. Now, from a technology standpoint applied to industry, we have what's called actigraphy. And basically, these are typical wristwatch devices that you wear, and they can measure the same biophysical components that a sleep lab does. So, there are advantages and disadvantages to actigraphy. The advantages, of course, is that they measure the same quantitative data that we would get if we sent somebody to a lab setting. They can identify sleep disorders, and we know that shift workers have a very high propensity for certain types of sleep disorders, particularly sleep apnea, which is kind of the poster child for sleep disorders. However, actigraphy is a latent measure. It measures how much sleep you've accumulated over time. It does not allow for real-time identification of fatigue in a person. Okay, but it can provide a lot of information in terms of, is our shift schedule allowing enough time off for people to get sleep? Are there some other ways that we can adjust our sleep schedule? So it does give you some very valuable information. Now, if we want to measure fatigue and impairment of performance, then we start looking at other methods. The only scientific validation out there right now is what we call PVT testing, or psychometric vigilance testing. And that allows us to measure things such as reaction time and being able to follow scenes and motion. And the best way to measure this is through a technology called eye gaze technology. There are other types of technologies out there. There are ones that measure brain waves. You put a hat on, it measures brain waves. There are some that you put a device on, it measures the head position. These have not been validated to the same significance and superiority as eye gaze technology has. So what eye gaze technology does is it measures what we call perclose, which is the percent closure of the eyelid as well as the blink speed of the eye closure. And that has a very validated response as to, is this person about to have a microsleep state, or is this person in a moderate risk of fatigue or high risk of fatigue? So what that allows us to do is we can take that information and feed it back directly to the employee or directly to a control center. So it provides workers with objective measurements. So if I'm operating in a cab and I've got this eye gaze technology, then basically what it's going to tell me is, oh my gosh, I'm slipping into this fatigue state. Maybe I need to get out, grab a cup of coffee or something along that line, or do something to increase my stimuli. In the control room operation, we can have it so that you can monitor different hauling trucks or whatever the case might be, and you go, operator B seems to be having some problem. Who's his supervisor? Okay, supervisor, go out and check on him. See what he's up to. Go do an intervention. All right? You can also get to that point where, you know what, this person is unsafe to be operating that vehicle. Maybe it's time to pull them off. So it allows for real-time identification of medium and high-risk situations to individuals and or control centers. And the device-specific features, there's different types of eye gaze technology out there. The ones that we would recommend are the ones that are non-invasive. There are some that require you to wear glasses. Then there are ones that require no physical component attached to your body. And those are the ones that we prefer, the ones where you have an infrared detector in the cab or in an environment that can detect the eye gaze. The ability to look at vehicle and specific operational alertness data is really important because as we collect this data, it's going to drive us to things such as do we need to revise our policies, our procedures, standard operating procedures. So technology, again, it is not a solution. It is simply a tool. We still need to do education and training with management. We still need to do education training with the employees. We have to teach employees how to optimize their sleep habits, how diet affects their sleep habits, how their socializing affects their sleep habits, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there has to be that balance between all of the information that we have available to us. So I'm going to leave it at that. There's probably a couple more slides that you'll see when you get your materials handed to you. At this point, I know I talk pretty fast when I go through this stuff because I know I have a short period of time. But any questions that you may have, I'm only going to be here until lunchtime today, unfortunately. I'm heading back to Canada after that. But please come up and ask me if you have any questions. There's one at the back there.
Rick McNay, CSX Railroad. Where do your statistics come from? And do you have any information on LED lighting for the nighttime worker?
On LED lighting?
Yeah, effects of LED lighting.
LED lighting hasn't been researched as much as the other types of lighting that we see. Most lighting has been researched in the control room environments, where we don't necessarily use a lot of LED lighting other than through your screen technology. What we know is that it's kind of dependent on the application of where that light is and what you're using it for. When we look at light, we want to have light that's based on lux and color temperature. So we're looking for light that is 5,500 K color temperature or close to 10,000 lux of light to give that boost of replication of sunlight. We want that exposure between 5 and 6 a.m. in the morning. After that, we want to depress it in the evening. So in terms of LED lighting, I really don't know enough. I don't want to pretend that I know more about LED lighting than I do, actually. Now, you mentioned a question about statistics. Which statistics were you talking about? Well, there was a variety of different ones up there in terms of, I'm not sure which slide you're referring to, but a lot of it has come through scientific sleep journals. That's the majority of it. Things like the NASA, the Stephen Ames Research Center for Fatigue, as well as the Liberty Mutual Research Institute and Australia. And I know there's some Australians there. Fabulous wealth of knowledge when it comes to fatigue management, and they really are the leaders in fatigue management in the world. Okay. Anything else? Thank you very much.